Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am Susan Franson, your host for today, together with Paul Wearson. Thank you for joining me to listen in. Hi, Paul.
Well, thank you, Susan. How are you today? It sounds as if there's a lot of Iowa history in the upcoming events here in central Iowa. To the west, we have Mara McKay telling us about Yesterboon, an event turning all of Boone into a living history museum this upcoming weekend, which will be September 29th to October 1st. And here in Ames, tonight, September 27th, there will be an original documentary film, Saving Brenton, which is touted as a journey to restore the legacy of America's greatest barnstorming movie man.
And hopefully we'll be making history at the KHOI studios tomorrow night, September 28th, with the next Pantorium session. Jose Mendez, a.k.a. Cuervo, will be performing. Ironically, Pat Schlarbaum's phonology report on nighthawks, a late summer migrating bird, is of local historical interest because of the legendary baseball team from Slater, the Nighthawks.
Phonology is documenting nature's happenings when they occur. The first bluebird of spring or the last meadowlark of autumn are noted in a journal for future reference. Today's phonology are migrating nighthawks. During these dog days of summer, some birds have already initiated migration. Reports of 50 to 100 nighthawks are being reported at Mason City and Davenport. Nighthawks are medium-sized, slender birds with very long, pointed wings. They measure 9 to 10 inches long, display a wingspan of 20 to 24 inches. They weigh 2 to 4 ounces and have a lifespan of 4 to 5 years. Common nighthawks are well camouflaged in gray, white, buff, and black. Their long, dark wings have a striking white blaze. Their buzzy pink call is distinctive. It often takes advantage of clouds of insects attracted to street lamps, stadium lights, and other bright lights at dawn and dusk. Only the small tip of the bill is usually visible, and this combined with the large eyes and short neck gives the bird a big-headed look. It's sometimes called a bull bat due to its perceived bat-like flight and the bull-like head and neck. Like the eastern whippoorwill, it's a member of the Caprimulgidae family, a group also known as nightjars. Another name is goatsucker. The Latin for goatsucker is Caprimulgus, hence the family name. Goatsucker is from an archaic, erroneous idea that the birds would fly into barns at night and with their large mouth opening, suck dry the udders of goats. The name nighthawk itself is a bit of a misnomer, since the bird does not hunt at night, nor closely related to hawks. I know that during the peregrine falcon restoration in Iowa, many early evening reports of long-winged dark birds were received that turned out to be nighthawks. When the description included impressive white bars upon the wings, these reports were deemed nighthawks rather than peregrine falcons. Throughout warm summer evenings, common nighthawks roam the skies over treetops, grasslands, and cities. Their sharp electric pink call is often the first clue they're overhead. In the dim half-light, these long-winged birds fly in graceful loops, flashing white patches out past the bend of each wing as they chase insects. These fairly common but declining birds make no nest. Their young are so well camouflaged that they're hard to find, and even the adults seem to vanish as soon as they land. During the day, they roost motionless on a tree branch, fence post, or the ground and are very difficult to see because their feathers look like tree bark. Common nighthawks nest in both rural and urban habitats, including woodland clearings, prairies, open forests, and rock outcrops. They also nest on flat gravel rooftops, though less and less often as gravel roofs are being replaced by the smooth, rubberized roofs that provide an unsuitable surface for nesting. Common nighthawks eat flying insects almost exclusively. They hunt on the wing, opening their tiny beaks to reveal a cavernous mouth well-suited for snapping up flying insects like an enlarged vacuum cleaner. Nighthawks eat any insects like queen ants, wasps, mosquitoes, beetles, caddisflies, moths, bugs, mayflies, grasshoppers, and other flying insects. They may also eat a small amount of vegetation. They occasionally forage during the day in stormy weather, but seem to never forage at night. Common nighthawks are usually solitary, but they form large flocks during migration. They have one of the longest migration routes of all North American birds. They may travel 1,600 to 4,200 miles where they winter in southern South America, including Paraguay, Uruguay, and Argentina. They migrate by day or night in loose flocks, frequently numbering in the thousands. No visible leader is observed. The enormous distance traveled between breeding grounds and wintering range is epic in duration. The northbound journey commences at the end of February, and the birds reach destinations as late as mid-June. The southward migration commences mid-July and reaches a close in early October. Threats to these interesting birds include pesticide use and habitat loss. Common nighthawks are also vulnerable to collisions with cars since they forage over roads or roost on roadways at night. Their population is seriously declining in many parts of North America. Causes may include changes in land use and overuse of pesticides. In some areas, nighthawks nesting on gravel roofs have been targeted by increasing urban populations of crows, which eat the eggs. Populations have plunged with a cumulative decline of 61% between 1966 and 2014, according to the North American Breeding Bird Survey. The 2014 State of the Birds report lists common nighthawks as a common bird in steep decline. In early 2016, American Bird Conservancy joined with beekeepers, farmers, and other public interested groups in filing a lawsuit alleging insufficient federal regulation of neonicotinoids, an insecticide widely used as a seed coating. A 2013 study by the American Bird Conservancy found that these neonics are toxic to birds and invertebrates, even in small quantities, and that they persist in soils for months and even years. Nighthawk numbers are declining, yet their congregated numbers during the migration this time of year provide uplifting inspiration to carry on the crusade to keep these birds with us into the 21st century. And that's our phonology for today. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio, the heart of Iowa, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames.
Thanks, Pat. Now, let's fly from the nostalgic Nighthawks of Slater to Yesterboone, and we have Mara McKay, the Executive Director of the Boone County Historical Society, here in the studio with us to tell us about it.
Well, now, Mara, I understand that this is the inaugural year for Yesterboone, and tell us about that. It's going to be exciting.
It is going to be exciting. We have a collection of artists, historians, interesting people and enthusiasts that are coming together to tell their interpretations of history, whatever that may be. And it includes a variety of different people that are performing, displaying, sharing their collections. And they're coming to Boone in 26 different locations. And we're delighted to have people that have things like cinematography or car collections or interpretations of the downtown Boone area along with Central Iowa history. So it's going to be incredible.
And that's this upcoming weekend?
That's this upcoming weekend. We start Friday, and people pick up a guidebook, and they go from location to location, getting to know these different historians and their artwork. And, for instance, at the Dutch Oven, you may walk in and see the wonderful photography of Rich Abramson. He's displaying A Soldier Says Goodbye, and it's his collection of photography that talks about a veteran's life, and it's pretty magical what he's put together, touching story and imagery. So everywhere you would go, as you follow your guidebook and map, you would then get to vote on who you would like to see win a prize.
Hey, that's great.
Yeah.
How many different venues are there then, or different locations?
25 different venues, and it includes everything from McHo's Park to the City Hall Auditorium, which is in an amazing Art Deco building, our facility, which is the Boone History Center, an old Masonic temple, 110 years old, I loved seeing the octagon in a Masonic temple. I think that's pretty interesting that the Masons are still founding some of our community projects. And then you can go around to different locations like schools, and DMAC is involved. So the University of Iowa will be bringing art share performers. So you can check out all of the different times and events that are performing and displaying.
So the people will decide themselves where they go and in what order. Mm-hmm. There's no guided tour or anything.
That's like correct. That. There is no rhyme or reason with where you would start this event, and you would take it on your own journey, join the conversation about history and why it matters, and have a good time.
Well, you know, the Boone Historical Society has this beautiful building.
Yeah, and truly.
The public probably who are not people who go to Boone regularly don't realize what a grand building you have. It's a great classical structure. It looks like a massive library or something.
Mm-hmm.
And when you came, there was sort of a crisis with that building.
Yes,
you've been
that's
here
true.
About, what, a year and a half, mm-hmm. you said?
That's
Tell
correct.
Us about the building.
Well, we had a 109 years old at that point, temple that had erosion that had started probably 109 years ago. The building was put together by the hands of many community members and Masons. And when I say Masons, I mean literally. Those Masons put together a building that by their hands, even in some of the clay work, when we saw the pieces that fell, you could see behind the masonry, their handprints.
Is that right?
Truly.
Now, this collapsed, and that was the front of the building, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this cost some money to reproduce and recreate and
Yes,
fix.
It did. We ended tuck pointing, fixing the entire building. We had to repair pieces that we were concerned would fall off if we didn't fix them. So the entire collapse of the front facade and all of the resulting damage around the building, as well as repairs that were needed, $217,000.
Oh, well, mm-hmm. mainly it's a question of this occurring right when your tenure began. So
yeah.
Here's something that happened mm-hmm. that wasn't really part of your job, but it's I just made the allusion to the allegory with Churchill, you came at just the right time to save everything.
Well, that's pretty high honorable
praise.
But I do think that our board and the people that surrounded us during that difficult time did pick up, well, so to speak, the pieces and move forward in a positive way. And I think Yesterboon is something that is a celebration of history that turns us in a new direction and brings people together to celebrate history and talk about why it matters.
And you want this to be an annual event.
Yes, we do. Our committee has been working on next year already, and we are looking for ways that we can engage more people. The Ames Historical Society, for instance, will be a partner on this event for this year, and we're hoping to build that partnership along with others in Central Iowa and make this a celebration that kind of exceeds the normal boundaries of our community. And that's going to be fun to watch.
Now, how extensive is the need for volunteers on this project?
It is extensive. We have exhibit boosters that will be supporting the exhibits and the venues. And then we also have exhibit leads that will be going around from site to site. And those exhibit leads are very important to make sure that everything is working smoothly. The exhibit boosters will be taking people's votes and their registrations and helping us to make sure that the vote is a great vote. We like to joke that we don't want the Russians to get involved. So it's kind of exciting to be a volunteer on this project. So if anyone is interested in listening, we would still accept some help for this year. We did just finish up our volunteer orientations, and we're moving forward with Friday and Saturday morning. On Friday, we have unique presentations, but I would say that if you're not busy on Saturday, that's definitely the day to go. We have a full agenda, and I think it's also been kind of a process of people getting their hands around the project. Some people found out a little bit late in the game, so next year even we may expand for an additional day as well.
I hope that happens.
I do too.
But I was just wondering, you mm-hmm. know, one thing that I'm really impressed with in Boone is the volunteerism.
Oh.
Susan and I did a road trip some time ago for the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway. And then we all know that Puffer Billy Days is a massive project in Boone, all volunteer intensive. I couldn't believe the number of volunteers involved in the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway. Well, here we are, another big project requiring volunteers. So accolades to Boone that you can have enough volunteers to do each of these three major projects. I'm very happy that you've been able to garner volunteers for this.
Well, I am grateful you mentioned that because I felt the same way. I was struck by the level of volunteerism as soon as I moved to the Boone area. And once we embarked on this project, people from all walks of life joined in and gave us their support. We've had phenomenal volunteers leading the way. And I'd like to give out a shout out to Donna Connington, who's my co-chair. She stepped up and we were able to cultivate a lot of relationships around Yester Boone. So you're right. And the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad has also been a strong partner for us. And this is a great fit for them, getting them to be able to share, allowing them to share some of their unique history that they may not always get to talk about. But on their platform this time, they have Teddy Roosevelt impersonator, and they also have the Scratch Belt water tank that'll be at Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, have the businesses and organizations in town been supportive?
Excellent. You? Yes. Everything from R.H. Graybaugh to Nearham and Associates, BAME Insurance. We could continue to list them all, but they have really come around and embraced this project. Hy-Vee has helped us with a component called Hy-Vee Vintage Gourmet, where people will actually submit their recipes and be judged on their recipes. That's the juried section of the competition. So we have two Epicurean categories, one barbecue and one vintage gourmet. So those are pieces that we're developing, and we couldn't do any of this without our volunteers and our partners.
And it's important to realize that this is the inaugural year.
Yes.
And so when that happens, you're really founding everything. You're present at creation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there will be things that go wrong for you, and there are things that are going to, and I think you're going to find in terms of the venues, what sort of things people respond to, the greater responses.
I think that's a very insightful comment. I think you're right on it. And we are expecting to have some bumps along the way. We've already seen areas that we can polish and improve for the next year. We do feel that people are going to get a buzz around certain events or certain interpretations. And we hope that they will be energized by what they see at the event. And also gives an opportunity and a platform for artists and historians and people that typically aren't seen as friendly competitors to come together and have a little fun and try and win something. So that gives a different perspective.
Well, it's interesting. There are competitions here.
Right.
And motivators for people to really perform.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what you're going to have is a lot of folks who step out and participate and go to the venues. You're going to have what I call the awe factor. Awe.
Yeah.
I didn't expect this. Now, I'm from Story City. Well, for years they had a little Sut na Mai celebration.
Yes.
Which is the celebration of Norwegian Independence Day.
Wonderful.
Well, see, that evolved into Scandinavian Days, which is the annual festival that became large.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope the same sort of fate awaits you.
Well, we would love to think that.
Because you start it now, and then you get great word of mouth and good participation and a lot of people who are going to spread the word that we had a great experience this weekend, and I learned so many things I didn't know. And then you're talking about the foods that are available. If people really follow this venue, the listing you have that you hand out, I'm sure.
Yes, absolutely.
They're not going to regret going to all these places.
Mm-hmm.
And we probably should talk to you at some point to see how things went, you know.
Yeah, we would love to come back and share that.
Mm-hmm. I just love to be involved in talking with somebody who is present at creation when a brand new event is created. And I just think that this, of course, I'm a history buff myself, so I'm highly vulnerable to this sort of event.
I like it. We hope it's infectious. And that the museums, all of the museums in our system for Boone History Museums are changing and evolving, and I believe that this event will bring them to a different level because they'll be utilized. And we have, like as you mentioned, Boone and Scenic Valley. We have Cole School on our map. Next year, we hope to have Sweet Valley Church, which, if you've never been, is a church located out in Ogden that's just a spectacular, inspirational venue of its own. And we hope that this kind of an event will be able to build and strengthen those historical structures that have been lovingly preserved in our area, and maybe even interest people to do more along the lines of preservation.
Well, I know that when you see interviews done, for instance, there was a program segment once. They were out on the street in New York City talking to New Yorkers about how many of them had been to the Statue of Liberty. And it was a pretty low number. You take for granted the things that are immediately there. Even something as obvious and prominent as the Statue of Liberty isn't visited by the people who live nearby.
That's a great word. It's true. And a lot of people have overlooked sometimes. We have the Kate Shelley Park and Depot, which is currently closed. But we have the Mamie Eisenhower birthplace, which has drawn a lot of visitors over the area. And this is a perfect time. There will be no charge for coming into the Mamie Eisenhower birthplace during the weekend of Yesterboon. And we also look forward to people seeing, as you mentioned, the beautiful Boone History Center. Hickory Grove is a country school that is also located in the Boone area near Ogden, and that will be open along with Batten Chapel, which is right next to the Hickory Grove School. So it is a terrific opportunity for people to come in and enjoy history in all forms.
Well, you know, if you've just joined us, we've been talking about the Yesterboone weekend coming up in Boone, Iowa. We've been talking with Mara McKay, director of the Boone County Historical Society, talking about all the great things that will be happening in Boone, Iowa, where they're reliving all the past and doing it in such an interesting and entertaining way this weekend in Boone. And Mara, good luck, have fun, and hope you get a mob.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, just a reminder that this is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area. KHOI 89.1. And we're in the midst of our local talk show, and you've been listening to our radio station here with Susan and I, Susan Franson, as our co-host today. And we've been talking about people, stories, and events in Central Iowa, typically in local talk, and our next story combines all three. The person is Michael Zahn, who we'll be talking to. He's featured in the documentary Saving Britain, the story of how he discovered the show reels and brought them back to the movie theaters where they first showed a century ago. And the event is at Benton Auditorium, that's in the Iowa State Center here in Ames, where you can talk with the subject of the documentary and filmmakers Tommy Haynes, John Richard, and Andrew Sherborne. But you don't have to wait to meet Mike Zahn, the man who discovered the show reels. He happens to be on the line with us right now, and later we'll hear from filmmaker John Richard. Hello, Mike.
Good morning.
Hey, I just saw you on the trailer for the film. You are a distinguished man with a prominent beard. And tell us about Brinton.
Frank Brinton was an unusual person in the 1800s. He became very interested in projected entertainment and started doing illustrated lectures about 1880, where he would talk and illustrate with projected magic lantern slides. And As more things became available, he was always ready to add things to his equipment. And when movies became available, first movie in our country was about 1894. He was showing movies by 95 or 96. And what was unusual is that, you know, he was the first probably to be showing movies in Iowa, but he kept everything. And so we have 130 to 150 of his movies, the most recent of which is 1908, and Magic Lantern slides and sound recordings. And it's what people in the middle part of the United States were entertained with 120 years ago.
Now, how did you discover these? Let's talk about this eureka moment here. How did you find out about all this?
The Brentons were always people that I was interested in. Their house was right by the school where I taught. Mr. Brenton was working with heavier-than-air aircraft as early as 1890. He had a landing strip on his house. So I was always talking to my students about the Brentons. And the son of the executor of the Brenton estate was cleaning out his father's basement, and his father had kept the entertainment part of the estate. And I was able to obtain that material in 1981.
And so this was a great discovery. It must have been marvelous to take a look at this. It had just been stored for a long period of time. Is that correct?
Mr. Brenton had died in 1919, and the material had been stored since then. And there were three pickup loads of material, many boxes, thousands and thousands of articles in the collection. And I taught junior high students right next to where this was stored, and I moved a lot of the things to the school and worked with students on proper methods of cleaning things, and so we had an adventure going through everything.
So the students learned a lot about film preservation, and they also
worked so much with the films because the films were cellulose nitrate and subject to explosion, which is not something you try to do at school.
No, I wouldn't do that.
They cleaned Magic Lantern slides and organized paper material and things.
Well, of course, the thing that comes up to my mind is the challenge of preserving these films. I've seen features elsewhere where they're preserving all these great old Hollywood films in very sophisticated storage areas at a specific temperature and humidity, because that's the cellular, you know, the film that needs to be preserved. And what kind of problems are incurred here with these films or shows?
Well, the films were, in 81, a number of the films were sent to the Library of Congress, American Film Institute in Washington, D.C., and they copied some of the films on 16mm and sent them back to me and kept some of the originals there in temperature and humidity-controlled vaults. But the films they didn't copy, which were a number of reels, they were sent back here, and I just kept them in a box in a shed in our yard, and they were preserved as well until about 3 years ago. We had all of them digitized. We took them out to Pittsburgh, where they were digitized, and the originals of the films are now at the Library of Congress in Culpeper, Virginia, and in a vault in Pittsburgh. And then we work with digitized copies now.
Well, it's really nice to know that they're preserved for all time.
Not. Cellulose nitrate is a very unusual substance, and it can deteriorate at any time. When I was at the Library of Congress one time, we pulled one of the Brenton films off of the shelf, and it was in 29-degree temperature, perfect humidity, air exchange, everything ideal, and we pulled it off the shelf, and it was turning to powder.
So
the chemical makeup of the film and the emulsion and everything was not standard, and over time different chemical compositions on the film deteriorate at different rates.
Wow, interesting. I've already learned a lot today. Now tell us how this film that you're featured in evolved. What happened there?
I live just south of Iowa City, and there are there were three documentary filmmakers in Iowa City that were made aware of these films about the same time. I had not ever met any of them, and so they came down and started going through the collection and talking and became interested in it. And so 4 years ago, they started filming a documentary about the films and the preservation and the other things in the collection.
Well, you have a prominent role in that film. I saw the trailer, and I think it's really thought-provoking and informative. And I bet you had fun doing that, didn't you?
Well, the film guys are just really outstanding individuals, and it was great fun to work with them. And they've done a marvelous job of putting together the story, and it showcases Washington County, and it showcases Iowa, and the importance of preservation, and they've just done a tremendous job with the film.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting, especially for folks here in Ames, and this showing is going to be happening here at Ames at the Iowa State Center in the Benton Auditorium.
And I will be there to answer questions and explain things.
And explain to people when this is and anything else they need to know to here in Ames to be out there to see that.
Well, it's at 7 o'clock tonight at the Benton Auditorium, and the film runs about an hour and a half, and then we'll do question and answers, and we may even show some of the original films from 120 years ago.
Well, this is wonderful, because I think for anyone interested in the history of film, Mike Zahn here is going to be available after the show, and it's going to be a great thing for everybody to take a look at and understand this very early venture into the film industry. And thank you, Mike, for being with us today. We'll see you on screen and in person at Benton Auditorium in the Iowa State Center tonight.
And I'd like to just break in because I once performed in Benton Auditorium, and otherwise I wouldn't know where it is. It's in the Scheman Building. You'll have to go up in the elevator. It's just a room, large auditorium in Scheman. And I've also seen the trailer and recommend it. I'm looking forward to going.
Thank you again, Mike.
Look forward to seeing you.
Okay. If you've just joined us here at KHOI Radio FM, 89.1, Story City and Ames surrounding area, we've been talking about something going on at Benton Auditorium in the Iowa State Center tonight. It's called Saving Brenton, story of how, well, we're going to have someone tell you about the film who's actually been involved in the filmmaking. And we've just talked with Mike Zahn earlier about Saving Brenton. Now it's time to turn to John Richard, one of the filmmakers telling Mike's story. Welcome to KHOI, John. Are you there, John? I hope we didn't lose him. He's one of the filmmakers who will be featured tonight at the Benton Auditorium. And basically, he's the man who put this thing together, or the part of a team that put it together. And as Mike was saying earlier, this is really something unique that you're not going to see too often. It's about all the earlier things about the movie-making industry, and I think we have John here right now.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, wow. Now, how did you discover the movies that Mike had? Tell me about that moment.
Well, the filmmaking team kind of met Mike in a couple different ways. I met him through Red Cedar Chamber Music, a musical group that had been that he was working with to put music to these movies that he'd found. And they, I'd been working with them for a while, and they said, "Hey, we've got this really interesting guy, and you should meet him." And I met him, and he showed me some of the movies, and I just immediately knew that this was something pretty special.
Well, you know, I just saw the trailer of the film today, and I was kind of taken by the music background just on the trailer. They made some good musical choices there. And now, who's involved in it? We want to give credit to other people involved in the project. You're John Richard. Yeah. Who else was involved in the filmmaking side of this?
Andrew Sherburn and Tom Haynes and I are the three principal filmmakers, and then we worked with a bunch of different people at various points for various things, but the three of us made up the primary team.
Now, how long did it take to do this project? It sounds kind of extensive.
Yeah, well, we filmed on it for almost, filmed and edited for almost 4 years. When we started, we definitely didn't know it would take quite that long, but with the documentary film, you just got to kind of go until that you feel like there's a story that's ready to go. And with this one, it just kept unfolding for us as different things happened with the collection, and we met different people, and different things happened.
Well, now, place that in time. When did you have a finished product?
We finished the film this fall. We were actually still filming on it a bit last summer, but did our post-production on the sound out at Skywalker Ranch in San Francisco, which was pretty neat, and then finished up the film this fall.
Now, talk about the mechanics of getting out there and scheduling all the things you do. Is this opening night tonight, or is this the first showing?
This will be the third showing in Iowa. So we were fortunate, and we had our world premiere at the American Film Institute Documentary Film Festival in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago, and that was amazing. We actually were able to bring the hand crank projector that the films were originally shown on out there and crank that. Mike probably talked about that. And then we did two shows in Washington, Iowa, which is where most of the film takes place. So then Ames is our next destination.
Well, what kind of response did you have at the festival?
Oh, it's been amazing. We've sold out all the shows that we've done so far, and people just really, really love the film, and they love Mike. And I think we sort of knew that would happen. I mean,
Well, Mike, I saw in the trailer he's. He looks so, such an interesting guy with a big beard and everything, and he just really is cinematic in his appearance. So definitely having Mike on film is a real asset to you. But I think that people need to understand how complex filmmaking is and how, like when you said it was 4 years, that's remarkable that you're involved in a project that long, and people don't understand the intricacies of post-production and all the things you had to do to put this together. And I can see that it was a long-standing project that took a lot of work and time, and I assume you were involved with other projects during that time, too.
Yeah, it was a film that we could sort of, at least, we could work on different things. I mean, Andrew manages an independent theater here in Iowa City. I work on other projects as well. We all sort of... But this was our main project over the last few years. We were able to secure some grants for funding, and luckily the travel expenses were pretty minimal since it was all filmed for the most part in Iowa, apart from a couple trips overseas and out to the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
So when you have a film, you know, when I see at the Academy Awards, they always have the nominations for Best Documentary. And the stuff they show, the trailers from those documentaries, are fascinating. And I think to myself, how do I get to see these? Because they're not shown in theaters that often. So for the novice, how do people access films like this? Now, we're going to have a performance tonight out at the Benton Auditorium, but, boy, it's how often, how do you market that, or how does that happen that these things get distributed properly?
Well, I think we're trying to learn that on the fly. I think there's never been more outlets for documentary film. That's the good side for us. There's Netflix and iTunes and even YouTube, and all these different ways of getting a film out, all with their pros and cons. Some, you know, HBO and other big outlets, you know, they select a few films every year, but that's pretty rare. But there's never been more outlets for documentary films to be seen, which is much different than the past, where it would have been, like you said, much more difficult to actually see a film. But there's also more documentary films being made than ever before, so there's sort of more competition. So I guess some people are calling this the golden age of documentary film, and it's kind of has a two-edged sword.
Well, you know, that's just very instructive to me because, yes, the digital age and social media, you know.
I had a question when Mike was on, and that is he talked about all of the original movies being digitized, and the cost of that, I wondered, was that already done when you started the filmmaking? Or did you have that to fall back on?
Let's see. That would be a better question for Greg Prickman, who's the head of the University of Iowa Special Collections. They're the ones who were able to secure grants to digitize the films. A few of the films were digitized in a sort of lower quality when we began the project. But part of our project, especially after we visited the Library of Congress's nitrate vault where the films are stored under ideal conditions, and realized that even under ideal conditions the films were rapidly degrading, some of them, that it was imperative that we digitize them at high resolution as soon as possible. And that's part of the way we were able to get the funding to make that happen. So now we're still in that process, actually, but we've got, for instance, all of the hand-colored films digitized at very high resolution. They're, you can see the individual grains on them if you load them up on your computer, so it's pretty amazing.
Well, that's fantastic, John, and I think that everyone needs to be reminded that this film, Saving Brenton, will be shown at the Benton Auditorium here at the Iowa State Center, the Scheman Building, tonight. What time is the showtime?
I believe it's 7 o'clock.
And then I understood from Mike that you folks and Mike will be available for Q&A and for people to ask pertinent questions about everything connected with the show, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of my favorite parts about taking the film on the road, is being able to talk to people and answer their questions. And yeah,
I would say you're living the dream. So that was John Richard, a filmmaker, a guest here on Local Talk today, about Saving Brenton, featured tonight at 7 o'clock at Benton Auditorium in the Iowa State Center. And this is about very early era in the filmmaking industry.
Thank you, Paul. KHOI will host a live concert here in our building this coming Thursday. This is part of our ongoing Pantorium Sessions that is organized by KHOI volunteers and features local artists. The shows are broadcast live on the air at 7 p.m., but we also love to have you come to be part of the live audience to enjoy and support the artists. This Thursday, Jose Mendez, a.k.a. Cuervo, will be performing. His performance will not only feature music, but will have a visual component. It's a multimedia performance, so for that, you have to come to the station. The performance is on Thursday, September 28th at 7 p.m. at our studio at 410 Douglas Avenue. Entrance is free. Evan Taylor, KHOI's operations manager, spoke with Jose last week about how he does his art.
The following segment is an excerpt of an interview that I did with Jose Mendez, who will be performing at KHOI under the moniker Jose Cuervo this Thursday at 7 p.m. as part of our monthly Pantorium Sessions concert series. Jose plays some funky stuff, too. He's in here with a couple of Ableton Push, what are those, like touchpads, Jose?
Yeah,
like
MIDI controllers. They can basically do whatever you want them to do in Ableton. Yeah. They can be a synthesizer, they can be drums, they can be used for DJing, controlling lights. It just looks like a big fancy light bright.
Yeah, definitely. And they figure in very heavily to your various performances that require electronic music. I know that not only the World Bank, where you produce a lot of wonderful beats, but also in your electronic music project, Jose Cuervo.
It's just kind of random music. It's whatever I feel like making. There's no real, like, genre. So sometimes I make some spooky stuff with, like, Holly Figueroa. Sometimes some dancey stuff. Sometimes it's – I'm trying to make it mostly be live finger drumming. So it's, like, improv that I'll just take a random song and try and make a improv song out of it.
Yeah, definitely. Having followed and watched a lot of your videos that you put up to the Facebook, I think I really enjoyed the one where you sampled Legend of Zelda music and played with that.
Yeah,
that was a lot of fun.
That was a lot of fun. I should have explained a little more what I was doing, because I was talking to a friend, and it can come off as if you're just playing to a backup track, but really what was going on is I sampled Ocarina of Time Fairy Fountain. And I put the samples on my electronic drum kit on the cymbals, so there was four different samples to work with on the ride part of the cymbal and the crash part, so I was able to make a song with drums and cue up the samples.
Yeah, and I mean, seems like you have something new kind of hitting us every couple days or so.
Yeah, I try to stay active.
Yeah. It's the best way to do it. I mean, I've always been kind of curious about those MIDI controllers. Is like, how do you keep track of which button does what? I mean, I'm looking at each one and they have, I don't know, just kind of guessing, trying to do some quick math in my head. Looks like 64 buttons apiece,
yep,
at least.
64 buttons, and there's knobs that control like 8 different channels. It basically is the brains to Ableton. So as long as I memorize where everything is, it works very, very fluid for me. It's not really labeled right now. It just looks like yellow and then pink over here. But I just memorize where all the samples are. Basically, I'll throw in a song on the left side. The Push 2 is my newer one. I'll throw some random song. Like some of the stuff I have queued up is African choir. So I sample little bits and pieces of an African choir and throw drums over it and just try and... I mean, there's mistakes in how I'm going to play just because I'm doing it right on the spot.
Right.
I got to hit the buttons accurately. They're velocity sensitive. So it feels good trying to put myself on the spot with something like this. I enjoy it.
Well, that's kind of the magic of live music, and why I, for one, love it so much is you've got that wabi-sabi in there, you know, that perfection and the imperfection. And, you know, like sometimes having something go a little bit wrong is part of the magic of part of what's great about what's happening. You know, you end up finding something new. It's sort of what they say about like jazz, for instance. There's not really any wrong notes.
Mistakes.
Exactly. That's right. I definitely didn't know that it was like velocity sensitive, though, which just makes it all the more impressive. I had no idea about that.
Yeah, I'm able to program some decent sounding drums by just knowing how to play drums and then programming them and then controlling the velocity. So if it's a harder snare hit, I hit it harder. If it's just a little tap, ghost flam or something, I can do those sort of things too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's where the drum training certainly helps out, you know, which is really cool. Now, you had both of these up at the hip hop show, right? Or just the one? Both?
Yeah, I use more than this when I play with John. I'll throw the guitar in there and use the synthesizer a little more, probably. Maybe I'll use it. Maybe I won't use it today. I'm just using it as the audio interface. But usually, if I just have my Push 1 and Push 2, I'm good with that. That and my laptop.
Sure.
But even if I just had one of these, I can do some cool stuff.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that was a lot of fun. It was a really, really well-rounded show, too. Jose was doing his thing with the World Bank.
John Anonymous.
John, who is from Omaha, kind of a collaborative thing. I mean, If I'm recalling correctly, you guys got together in the first place because he just kind of heard some of your beats on the interwebs and, yep. you know.
Yeah, posted a song, and he just commented on it when I shared it. I just made it. I wasn't really planning on anything, and
right.
he commented on it that it would be awesome to rap over, so I said, go for it, take it, and that yeah. song blew me away. He did that again with the second song that were on my first album, both of those just surpassed what I thought they were going to sound like, so eventually I was like, we should just start a project together instead of you being featured on my CD. Let's just have something, like a real project together.
Yeah, like a standalone type of thing, and then... Yeah. Then, yeah, you also closed out the night with Sean Anonymous, another yeah. guy from up in the North Star state,
mm-hmm.
you know.
He's a stud.
Oh, yeah, he's incredible. I'd heard about him before, first time I'd ever had a chance to see him. How did you end up getting hooked up with Sean?
I've played with him before when I was doing solo stuff, and I used to have a name that I always give him and Philip Morris credit to changing, because I used to go by the name Jim Crow, and it was never anything negative. It was just, I like the animal crow. I love crows. And
right.
I tried to change the spelling to try and soften it up a little bit. And I got to explain myself too many times that, like, that's not me. I'm not trying to put out a bad message.
Right.
So instead of just having to explain myself, I wasn't that attached to the name. So I changed it to Jose Cuervo because I found out Cuervo is actually crow in Spanish. So
oh, no way.
I was like, that's such a gimmicky name. I should just roll with that. You'd think that hearing a name like Jose Cuervo, it's like party
right.
dude and all
oh,
that
yeah,
stuff.
Tequila and stuff.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. But yeah, I started playing with them, and they influenced me to change my name, and then I kept in touch with them and started playing more hip-hop shows here, and I remembered that he was one of my favorite acts to see, and Molly Clark knew him, so she got a hold of him, Philip Morris, and they started coming down here a few times. It's always fun having him around. He's an inspiration. He's a legit rapper.
We're talking about all these push controllers and MIDI controllers and synths and stuff like that, and Jose actually did bring his equipment into the studio to play some tracks for us today. So do you want to preface the mashup you're about to do with
yeah.
anything? Or?
I had played a show with Evan Campbell at Morning Bell, and the theme of the show was Hopeful Africa. The money earned at this show was going to be donated to a charity that was going to help get kids books and just help them with schooling stuff and learning. So since that was the theme, I decided just to do something special for that show. And not that many people have heard it, so I thought that'd be cool to do it on the radio. It's nothing fancy, but I just take little bits and pieces of an African choir, and I just mash them up with live improv. So if there's mistakes, it's cool. That's the beauty of it. There's no press and play in this one. If I make mistakes, it's because I made a mistake, and I'd feel better about that. So yeah, it's just basically African choir and just doing some samples with my left hand, drumming with my right hand, and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, definitely. So we've got Jose right here. He's going to be playing his mix that he did for the that Hopeful Africa show. And let's go ahead and take a listen.
Been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I have been one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Thank you for listening. Earlier in the show, we heard from Mara McKay, Mike Zahn, John Richard, Jose Mendez, a.k.a. Cuervo, and KHOI Nature reporter Pat Schlarbaum and operations manager Evan Taylor.
Now, Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Today's show was engineered by Rebecca Reuter. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris, and that's from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Harriet Island by Brian Keenan from the CD Hidden Falls.
And Jose Mendez playing his own music. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join us at the Local Talk team.
Let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878, or you can email us at khoiradio@gmail.com, or you can go to the contact page of our website, khoifm.org.
Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from Mary Greeley Medical Center, providing inpatient and outpatient services on a continuum of care, located at 1111 Duff Avenue in Ames. Find out more information at www.mgmc.org. That's mgmc.org.